support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway.
This is Jeremy Carroll, and we are sitting in Greenville, Tennessee, in the lobby of the General Morgan Inn.
Very cool. This is a very historic town, and the reason I came to town has everything to do with you and the National Park Service and a former president of the United States.
17th President Andrew Johnson, he did make his home in Greenville at about age 17. Now, he was born in Raleigh, North Carolina, served an indentured servitude, or part of one, I should say, over there, and then ran away from the indentured servitude, wound up in Greenville, Tennessee.
And he basically was uneducated. He didn't go to formal schooling, right?
Was not formally educated, although I do have some personal feelings on this. He was a master tailor. I feel like he was able to read a tape measure. He was reading, you know, shirt and coat patterns, pant patterns. He had to have been reading on some kind of a basic level.
Well, and then a step further, reading archival history at your National Park Center, his wife tutored him and read to him as he did his work.
Absolutely, she did. Eliza was educated here in Greenville at Ray Academy, well known in this area for educating females. I believe they had a male academy over there as well, and she was known for reading to him in the tailor shop as he plied his trade.
And back then, I mean, if you made it to the fifth grade across the board, you were doing good.
Absolutely, you were. In a way, he was probably ahead of a lot of the other children. He had a skill, a very profitable skill, something that you would not learn in grade school.
It's really interesting time and place where he was in eastern Tennessee. This was a part of the South. Tennessee seceded from the Union, and yet northeastern Tennessee, for the most part, was pro-North.
I am a native Georgian, and when I came here, I have a little bit of a different perspective on things. The first thing you notice here is that the land, the topography, is not set up for large-scale agriculture. But a lot of the whites here, they were skilled laborers. One of the things from Georgia that I remember, especially from the city of Macon, is that most of the homes there were built by three men. One of them was a slave-owning white man with the last name of Ayers. The other two were Primus Moore and Ben Jackson. They were enslaved men, but they were master carpenters. I believe that the whites up here were afraid of slave competition. It worried them.
So that's what drove them to side with the North.
As a Georgian, looking at it from my point of view, I would certainly have to say it had a lot to do with it.
And that's interesting because the same thing happened in California. Statehood had been around 1850 there, and coming up 1859, that was still the height of the gold rush. You had tons of Southerners there who brought their slaves. And there was a strong, powerful position to support the North, and it had everything to do with unfair economic competition. That's what was the anti-Southern, anti-slavery momentum, literally, in this document.
Absolutely. When you look at the enslaved labor, one reason that it had not taken hold in the North as much as it had in the South, the North had a lot of immigrant labor, a lot of factories. It all came down to cheap labor. In the North, a lot of that cheap labor was free. In the South, a lot of it was in bondage.
But again, back to President Johnson, he was pro-constitutionalist on one level and sympathetic in some ways with the black cause. He passed legislation for creating Howard University, for example. So a lot of complexities there. And he had been a slave owner.
Absolutely. If you go back and you look at Johnson in the 1850s and early 1860s, he believed in slavery. He was a slave owner. However, he did help get Howard University going. He also helped get the local freedman school going here in Greenville. With that said, you know, he was a product of his era. A lot of men in this area felt the same way. It was an across-the-board feeling for the most part.
And I heard a story locally. He freed one of his slaves and gave her his tailor shop when he was in D.C. to use for her business. Is that true?
He did rent her the tailor shop. Dolly and her youngest son, Will, they took the tailor shop over, turned it into a bakery, did quite well. Dolly was a special individual. She had a work ethic second to none. She never gave up, no matter how bad her situation was. We are talking salt-of-the-earth type people. She was an independent African-American female, former enslaved female, successful business owner in the 1860s and 70s in Greenville, Tennessee.
And so, accepted in the community.
And accepted and supported by this community, absolutely.
That's really cool. Let's talk about Andrew Johnson. He was sworn in as president because Lincoln was assassinated. He was a Democrat. Lincoln was a Republican. How did it go for him once he took over as president?
Lincoln had a finesse. Lincoln had the ability to negotiate. He had the ability to work other politicians. Johnson, on the other hand, was a lot more rigid. Once he made his mind up about something, that was the end of it. That was the crux of the situation. And so Johnson didn't have that finesse.
I mean to interrupt, but you made me think of, he was a war governor of Tennessee during the Civil War, and there was a lot of resistance against him because of that same autocratic stubbornness.
Absolutely. Johnson took quite a bit of backlash from it. Someone asked me, will history ever be kind to him? And I told this person, I said, well, during the war, before the war, a lot of Southerners hated him. After the war, a lot of radicals in the North hated him. To be honest with you, Johnson felt vindicated when he was reelected to the Senate in 1874. He just felt like the people of Tennessee had come to reaccept him.
Let's back up to his presidency, and he was impeached. And the why?
Yes, when I was in grade school, the only thing that I knew about Johnson was, and I'm dating myself, he was the only president that had ever been impeached. Of course, we've had two since, but I was also told he was the worst president that we ever had. What he basically did, he got rid of Winston Stanton, his Secretary of War. Stanton had been an appointee under Lincoln, had been approved by the Senate. The Senate believed that Johnson should have to have their permission to remove him. Johnson believed that he did not.
And he believed that because he did not appoint him. Lincoln had. And so he thought that was his escape clause, right?
Absolutely. He felt that way. Many years later in the 1920s, the Supreme Court took a look at the Tenure of Office Act, and they did deem it unconstitutional. So he was vindicated, although 50 years or plus after his death.
Mm-hmm. And again, like you alluded to earlier, he was perceived as not a good president, as a mediocre president. How much of that was propaganda and not true, and was he unjustly viewed negatively from history?
My personal feeling is this. No president has ever had to put the nation back together after it has been separated by a civil war. He had quite a task ahead of him. He said what was on his mind. He didn't, as we would say, sugarcoat anything. He was not worried if it hurt your feelings. He would tell you what you needed to hear, whether you wanted to hear it or not. And yes, I do believe that that factored in people's opinion of him.
So it'd be fair to say that he was a very stubborn, strict constitutionalist.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
And even that being said, if you dug up his grave, what would be under his head?
The Constitution itself. He would be wrapped in an American flag.
He had requested that, right?
He did. That is what he wanted. That is all he wanted.
That's really interesting. So literally he was stubbornly guided by what he believed the Constitution directed him to do or not to do.
At one point he made the comment that he was to follow the Constitution as he read it and as he interpreted it.
What most fascinates you about Johnson? I mean, you've gotten to know him quite well in some way.
I am impressed with the fact that he died a very wealthy man. He did not inherit the wealth. He came up in a poor family. Everything he had, he created. He had a skill. He was good at what he did. He was a good orator, public speaker, and he just made the best of it. He played the hand it was dealt, and the jackpot was momentous.
Did he have kids here?
He did. That is one of the saddest parts of the Johnson story. He did have five children. His three sons, one died after the Battle of Stones River from a head injury. Another overdosed on laudanum, which is basically a liquefied opium, suffering from what we believe was PTSD.
So they served in the Army?
They did. His two oldest did. Many have asked, was his second son a casualty of the Civil War? And I say no. He died in 1869, but the war is probably what killed him. And then the youngest son, Andrew Jr., he died at 26 years old, and like his two older brothers, they had no children. And so the Johnson name actually died with Johnson. His daughters, the descendants, were Stovers and Pattersons from his two daughters.
Are there any descendants still in the area?
There are not in the area. And as a matter of fact, I am told, I'm not going to name them, but there's a mother and a daughter pair up north. And I am told if the daughter doesn't go ahead and have some children here fairly quickly, this may be the end of the Johnson line.
So maybe you want to invite them down for some sort of a reunion. That would be cool.
It would be nice, although I don't believe that they play up their relationship to Johnson. Very private, which I respect that.
Well, let's loop back to your world and your job and what you do. His home here has been restored to as it was, and it's open to the public, and it's operated by the National Park Service, and that's you.
The home is extremely special. It never left his family. Everything in it, I would say 80 to 90% of it, belonged to Andrew Johnson. The house remained in his family until his great-granddaughter deeded it, along with the contents, to the Park Service in 1956.
Well, that's really cool.
Incredible. To me, we've just got a lot of his things to tell his story. It sets it apart. This is the home that he purchased in 1851. He vacated it in 1861 because of the war. He returned to it in 1869, but it played a very special part in his early time in Greenville. When you visit the homestead, there are two springs in the backyard. The first night that Andrew Johnson ever spent in Greenville was spent on the ground next to those two springs. 25 years later, with that home almost finished, he approached the owner and he purchased it. He was a sentimental man.
It's been years since I've been in his home, but I remember being in the attic, and I was told by the ranger that the graffiti you saw that is there today was placed by Confederate soldiers who were bivouacking there.
I have been told it was by Confederate and Union soldiers. Both of them used the home during the war. A lot of visitors will notice that all of the walls are papered. The reason for that, Mary, his youngest daughter, was sent back ahead of the family to renovate the home. She didn't have time to replaster and repaint. She just repapered over the graffiti and forgot that it was ever there.
That's really interesting. So there's a lot of archival history that's buried below the surface today.
Absolutely. These soldiers spoke their feelings. From what I understand, some of it is not really nice. We do have a section open down there where you can see some of it. Not going to tell you what it says. You'll have to come visit to see it.
So if somebody did want to come and visit Greenville and the Andrew Johnson Presidential Home, where are you located? How would they get here from you know, a major Washington or whatever.
If you're coming from the north, I would probably come in on I-81, Interstate 81. From the west or from the east, I would probably come in on Interstate 40. We are about an hour and a half from Knoxville. We are very near what is known as the Tri-Cities. We're a part of the Tri-Cities area, Kingsport, Johnson City, Bristol. We are in that area. And so look us up. Come see us. We'd be glad to have you. Check us out at thenationalparkservice.com. You'll go down, find us, Andrew Johnson, National Historic Site, Greenville, Tennessee. And my name is Jeremy Carroll. I'm a National Park Ranger at Andrew Johnson, National Historic Site in Greenville, Tennessee.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. And I'm Tom Wilmer. We'll see you here.
Support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Nashville's Big Backyard, a nonprofit economic initiative focused on rural destinations along the fabled Natchez National Parkway. With a focus on rural communities, such as Leaper's Fork, not far from Nashville, the Big Backyard journey traverses through Tennessee's southwest quarter down into Alabama's legendary Shoals region, the mothership of American music. The featured rural community's common thread is historic architecture and a timeless, charming small-town atmosphere, some with a river running through it. The diverse attractions of the featured communities include the amazing Elephant Sanctuary in Hohenwald, where retired circus elephants come to retire in peace, and iconic destinations like Northern Alabama's Shoals region, where you'll find one of America's most iconic Frank Lloyd Wright homes and two of America's legendary recording studios that have been etching American soundtracks since the early 1960s. For example, Muscle Shoals Sound Studios in Sheffield, Alabama, opened in 1969, instantly started marking up the charts with number one hits by recording artists like the Rolling Stones, Willie Nelson, Wilson Pickett, Linda Ronstadt, Rod Stewart, and Paul Simon. Nashville's Big Backyard's ardent promoters include Mike Wolfe, host of History Channel's American Pickers TV series, who provides a surgical contextual lens focused on Nashville's Big Backyard's diverse initiatives, and Liz McLaurin, president of the Land Trust for Tennessee, an equally passionate supporter of Nashville's Big Backyard's greater good elements through the Land Trust Preservation Initiatives. To learn more about the program, log on to nashvillesbigbackyard.org.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.